That's amazing. Welcome to Tear Gas and Gumdrops. You know what? I sound like I'm half asleep because I am. I think I gotta take another sip of this coffee. Welcome to Tear Gas and Gumdrops, the podcast about the pain and suffering of ministry. My name is Chris Morton, coming to you from Austin, Texas, and I'm here with...
I don't know if I want to say my name after that intro. Hey, this is Kyle Sapp from Antioch, California.
Right.
Chris, you seem to enjoy that iced coffee that you just drank.
Man, it's so good. This is actually Japanese iced coffee.
You are such a freaking hipster. I mean, you're drinking iced coffee, first of all, right. And it's not just, like, normal. It's Japanese.
It's not toddy. Yeah, well, in the afternoons, I don't drink toddy. Iced coffee, like, regular cold brew, like, it's, like, 3 cups of coffee for every 1 cup. So, after, like, 2 in the afternoon, I try not to do that. But I love it. You say this as you untwist the cap on an entire 2-liter mountain of, what is that, Dr. Pepper?
Dr. Pepper. I did it for the joke. I did it because I thought it would be funny.
Well, maybe
it was. I enjoy irony. I bet your iced coffee has some kind of cute little Japanese advertising character.
An emoji?
Yeah, like an emoji with legs.
Or a cat.
John Oliver, everything in Japan has some kind of cute, adorable emoji-type character.
That's how they express themselves. You know what's awful is that... So, for the longest time... Well, no, let me rephrase this. So, only recently did I learn that espresso has no X in it. I'm that guy who's been saying espresso at the coffee shop for years. And so I've been really overcompensating and trying to say espresso, and now I can no longer say the word expression or express. Just now, I was like, oh, that's how, like, Japanese brands express themselves. They're so espressive.
That's right. Chris Morton forgot the letter X exists.
Overcompensating.
That's classic you, man. That's classic you.
Here we are.
I appreciate that about you. You do not do anything small. You go big or you go home. X is not in one word. It's not in any words. It doesn't exist. We are done.
My favorite Marvel comic is about the men.
That took me a minute to get.
Led by Professor Xavier.
Oh man, yeah, those guys are pretty fun,
pretty manly. Oh man, well,
and then the follow-up sequel, The Force.
The Force. Yeah.
All right. So hey, let's do a bad segue, and you know. What else is like X-Men?
What's that?
Pew Research material.
How is that?
People read them. What? Right?
You did not try very hard on that.
I did not. I really didn't.
I have another X-Men one, but I think we'll have to circle back around to it.
Okay, I'm sure you
this whole podcast is a setup for it now. yeah, so Pew Research material, huh? So even though we have this tendency to record and then release months later, there have been a few things recently that are in the news and or just in the calendar, and we want to address. And there was a pretty big one. we're still running late. We're still about 2 weeks late to when we're recording this. But the Pew Research Foundation released their study of religion in America. What's the actual name for it?
Oh my gosh. I mean, I have the document in front of me. I can't find the name of it.
Yeah. But basically...
America's changing...
Yeah. So their summary article on their blog is called America's Changing Religious Landscape. And this kind of felt like a bombshell to some people, I think. And it's one of those few stories that got into the mainstream news as well as just kind of Christianity Today and, you know, blogosphere, churchy blogosphere. But, yeah, so, Kyle, did you get a chance to look at it?
I did. I read it. I thought they could equally change the title, or if I wrote for The Onion, mm-hmm. I would write us a companion article called Pew Research Discovers That Sky Looks Blue.
So you're saying obvious.
Yeah, it felt a little like, duh.
Okay, so I think that's good. I think we should circle around to that. But before we do that, just a quick summary.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, so in 2007, and then again in 2014, the Pew Research Foundation did a huge survey of the American population in regard to religion. And this is an independent survey. It's not based on churches' own or denominational documents. It's based on self-reporting of normal people. And basically, what they saw was an overall drop. So the population is growing, whereby the Christian share of the population is dropping. The biggest drop, they did this in 2007, and then they performed as close as they could to the exact same study in 2014. So basically two identical studies to kind of show a change over that period of time. And for 7 years, these are pretty, pretty major numbers though. The biggest shift you're seeing from within the mainline Protestant denominations, dropping from 18.1% to 14.7%. There's a small drop in evangelical Protestants, a notable drop in Catholics. And I think this is what everybody's been talking about for a little while, but it's important to see good numbers on this. A huge rise in what people are calling the nuns, the unaffiliated, from 16.1% in 2007, up 6.7% to 22.8% in 2014.
Also, and I thought this was interesting, that there was a rise among non-Christian faiths as well.
That's true. And I think that if you read this carefully, what you see is a lot of what's going on here is related to immigration. And so that's my guess.
That was my question is, mm-hmm. how much of this change has been through immigration versus conversion versus, I don't know, deconversion?
Right.
If that's a word. Because it noted I thought it was staggering, like the numbers, like how many people are now in the United States, something like, 245 Shit. Million people yeah. are in America now? That's crazy. That's a lot of people.
Yep.
And so that was kind of my first thought was how much of this has to do with immigration in terms of the rise of non-Christian faiths.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that I'm sure that's part of it. And I don't know that this article is most of what I've read. So I'll just lay that out there, but, I don't know that this article really delves into this. What I will say is interesting is that they note that although these trends are more notable among millennials, that they are across the board and it doesn't matter whether you're white, black, Latino, college graduate, high school graduate, woman or men. So the drops in most categories, the rise in unaffiliated, the rise in non-Christian faith, that is being seen in every single category in the U.S.
Yep. And I get why people are scared by it or startled by it, mm-hmm. bothered by it. Like, I totally understand that. I'm not really all that surprised by it. Mm-hmm. And two, I'm actually kind of a little bit more hopeful.
Okay. Well, I'm gonna pause you there again because I want to circle back around to that here in a minute. But general. Okay. What do you think it even means though? Like for our actual makeup of our country and day-to-day life.
What do you mean by that?
Like, what is different from 2007? Or even what is different from 2000 and, or sorry, from 1950? You know?
Yeah.
Is this, what's really going on here?
Well, I'm not a, like a cultural anthropologist, so I'm not sure I'm really equipped to answer that.
Mm-hmm.
I think the thing that I thought was a little interesting was they made some comment about like the answers that the group gave, like when they were 18 to 24 and now they're 20 to 30.
Mm-hmm.
Where is it? I don't know. It's a 14 page article. It's hard to find my notes. But I think some of it is over the last few years, we've seen a big rise in the public discussion about homosexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen, you know, we're now 15 years after the big, the first initial wave of Catholic priest molestation charges that hit. Yeah. In about 2000, we are however many years we are into the quote unquote war on terror.
Mm-hmm.
that has put a big bad taste in a lot of the mouths, particularly in millennials who are tired of being at war, and who I would imagine, I could reasonably think you could argue this, feel that if, you know, I feel like we're moving away from that conservative side across the nation.
Mm-hmm.
And Christianity, unfortunately, gets kind of lumped into that.
Yeah.
You know, we get the religious right. We never talk about the religious left. We always talk about the religious right, probably because it, you know, it's not alliterated, right?
Probably.
There's no catchy phrase. So I think after, you know, I think all of those kind of play a factor. We've seen a lot of effort on the part of atheists to get out there. Richard Dawkins, mm-hmm, Sam Harris, mm-hmm. Bill Mayer, Ricky Gervais.
Right.
Right. You know, these guys, and I don't actually know Ricky Gervais's like actual religious beliefs, but I watched a stand-up routine where he read the Bible and pretty much just mocked it. Mm. So yeah. I would imagine he's not pro-Jesus. So I think that has played a huge factor in it, that these guys are gaining ground, like, you know, yeah. They're putting into it. Not that atheism has ever been passive per se, but...
Right, right. Well, it's definitely not passé.
Yeah, that's true. And some of it could also just be just that typical generational rebellion that we see, you know, just in the cycles of, we could say perhaps, sure, that in the 80s and 90s there were, you know, there was a rise in religion, or at least it kind of felt like that from my perspective. And now those people are having kids and their kids, right, are kind of growing up, or people are, you know, just kind of reacting to the religion of their parents. And now those people are, you know, in their 30s and in their 40s, and they had bad experiences. And I feel, mm-hmm, like I hear more and more about that. More and more people are talking about having bad experiences with religion.
Yeah.
Than having good. And that's a little troubling for me.
Okay.
Because I just feel like surely there are more people that have, there are more positive stories, and maybe it's because we've forgotten how to tell good stories, in terms of how our faith really matters to us.
Okay, so I want to summarize what I think you just said. What I hear you saying is that over the last few, let's say the last few decades, but especially the last decade, there have been a number of things that have kind of shaken the image of America as a Christian nation, and whatever that means, it was generally considered a positive thing. The bad taste in people's mouth from 9/11, the bad taste in not bad taste, but the absolute trauma of those who were hurt by the Catholic Church and things like that. There, where it used to be that you could kind of just, if you didn't have an opinion, you could just kind of lump yourself in with Christians. It's harder to do that when you see things that are really gross happening. And then when, so then you add to that some really outspoken atheists, and really atheists is probably even the wrong term, but people who are anti-religion, who have a real, are on a real crusade against fundamentalism. You have a number of those people in the pot to kind of taking advantage of that shift, or at least being brought to light in that shift. Whereas they might not have had had a voice, they would have had such a minority voice in the past. So if nothing else, if I'm hearing you right, if nothing else here that's happening is that it's no longer easy for people to just call themselves Christians.
I don't think I said that, but I think I would I would agree with that statement. I think a lot of it is people, because it's not as cultural, because mm-hmm. it's, you know, it's like, yeah, I'm a Christian, blah, blah, blah. But here's the thing that just kind of irks me a little bit about this research and people's thoughts on it. Like, we've known this since Resident Aliens was written.
Right.
Was 84. Like, that book is, 30 years old now? 31 mm-hmm. years old? Like, this, this is a culture shift, and that of course, takes time. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't surprise me that we're there, because that's just kind of, you know, culture shifts themselves, they're slow moving. We're still not kind of done, I think. I don't think the church is going to die from it. I don't think that's where this shift moves.
Right.
But I think we're going to stop having as much political clout as we've had, if we even should have clout.
Speaking. I'll put that on the list of things we're hopeful for that we'll circle around to in a minute here. When I read this, I had that kind of same general reaction that you did, which is, of course. this is what I've been talking about all along. And I don't mean to say that I'm some sort of soothsayer or I'm smarter than other people, but I think this is the world that I've been operating out of for a while. And it's, but the numbers are still startling and meaningful. I'd like to kind of shift, because we try to talk about how this applies to our youth ministry and our church planting.
Yeah.
And so, in light of numbers like this, what do you expect? Like, how does this affect how you go about youth ministry? And maybe as you just look at youth ministry out there, like, do you expect to see a recognition of these shifts and changes? Or do you, again, hope that things will change somehow?
Yeah, well, at least on the West Coast, I don't know what it's like in the South, I don't look at how ministry works in the South because I'm not in the South. But kind of in the West Coast, we've just kind of been operating from that belief already.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of our kids, not so much in this form of my youth ministry, but in the past, we've had a lot of a higher percentage of kids whose parents don't come to church, who are coming to church now. We also kind of recognize a little bit that, for the most part, when a kid graduates from high school, he's going to most likely walk away from church. Mm-hmm. Not for any, for various cultural and just developmental reasons.
Right.
The thing that I thought of actually as I was reading this is not so much how do I apply this to my youth ministry, as it is, what do we do about college kids? What do we do about that later adolescent group that the church has failed across the board? Like we could argue that we set them up for failure by having these highly organized, structured youth ministries, and then we send them out to be adults in less structured, you know, because as adults are busy and college students are, you know, different, and, you know, adolescent development is all kinds of cray cray at that point. So in some ways we could argue perhaps that youth ministry sets them up for failure. I don't necessarily think that's true. I think what it means is that we just need to be better about connecting college students to adults, stable adults. Because if all college students are just connected to unstable college students, then, you know, it's kind of the blind leading the blind, which isn't necessarily always bad. Like, I'm not saying they shouldn't have any friends or anything, but they need some connection to older people who have, whether they have experience in their life, you know, so in wisdom to offer, they at least offer stability and a place to seek wisdom or to seek someone who can talk with them.
I
think that's a big thing for me right now, is where my thoughts are, is what can we do in terms of those college students and those 20s and 30s? Like, how do we, I don't even think it's necessarily getting them back. Like, how do we just reach?
Sure. Well, okay. So again, I'll try to rephrase what I think you said.
You wanted me to talk about youth ministry, but.
Well, no, I think you did. What I'm hearing from you is that the answer is not to have better youth ministry. The answer is to have, to be the church in a way that is meaningful to the same people as they age. You know, I definitely saw this. So I didn't grow up with the youth ministry, and it was really weird for me to, when you and I went to college together, to be around all these people who grew up in youth ministry. And I started to see, I don't know if you noticed this, had a lot of friends who had been baptized as young kids, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old. And then they go to college and they're encountering questions that they had never had before. And even in this little Christian college, it really, you know, would shake a lot of people's faith. And some people walked away, and some people, a lot of people imagined their faith. And a lot of people, you know, because baptism was really key to the tradition there at that school, a lot of people chose to be rebaptized at 18, 19, 20 years old. Were you one of those people?
I was one of those people.
And I don't have any, you know, that's not saying anything about that. I think it just is a example that I wonder if part of what's going on there is that they were presented a youth ministry rather than a lifelong faith.
And yeah.
When that was shaken, they had to reestablish their faith, and you did, and you made a commitment in that moment.
Here's the thing. Just in terms of youth ministry, it's really hard to expect a teenager to grasp the concept of a lifelong lived out faith, because words like identity are still, they're still forming for them. You know,
sure.
They're very abstract. And so it's very difficult, not impossible, but it's just very difficult, I think, for kids to really grasp what that commitment was like, or what that commitment means when, you know, when you're 12 versus when you're 18 versus when you're, you know, 25. Not to say that we shouldn't baptize kids when they're 12 or 18 or 25,
not
any of that theological, not wading into those waters, if you will, just making the observation that there's a difficulty there, that should be appreciated,
yeah,
and should, shouldn't be, we rejoice too quickly, I think. Like, hey, soulless end, yay. And it's like, I mean, yes, that's good. I'm not saying that's bad, but let's not, you know, let's not count our chickens before they hatch. Like, there's still a lot of journey left to do.
I'll make a statement. You tell me if you think this captures what we're talking about. Maybe what we're saying is that in, you know, well, we've gotten this far without saying the big word. In Christendom, you know, Christendom being the world where, you know, Christianity of a sort is taken to be normative. In Christendom, the way that the goal is to be good church. Everybody's in church, so the goal is to be good church. And the way to do that is to have market segments. So you have everyone's being good church, but you be a good denomination, or you be a good youth ministry, or you be a good children's ministry, or you be a good college ministry. And in a world where you can expect everyone to have some sort of Christian affiliation, then your thing is really to take care of that one flavor and get that flavor really down. And that as things shift away from, you know, that Christendom mindset where pretty much everyone has some sort of Christian affiliation, what you have to do is you have to draw back a little bit and say, no, we're not talking about just being good Christian college students. We're talking about a lifetime of discipleship of, you know, as Willard would say, apprenticeship to Jesus, which will happen at all of these different ages. And and you're looking for an approach where we bless them as they're teenagers in order to send them on a trajectory for the rest of their life.
Yeah, well, yes, I think so. So, and I think good youth ministry does this, where we recognize the, you know, intergenerational sticky faith stuff. So, for example, our senior Sundays this week is Sunday, and a few years ago we shifted that from celebrating what the seniors' accomplishment and, like, you know, doing this send off, now you're going out into the world, blah blah blah, to talking about how our seniors have impacted our community and how they've been a part of how they shaped us. To recognize that and to help them recognize that they're a part of our community. You know, it's kind of like what we talked about 14 podcasts ago on this you know, the covenant, the covenantal theology of, you know, you're part of us. You have shaped who we are. We have shaped who you are. And, you know, like, so Sunday is all about what have our seniors taught us, and as well as the seniors responding in how the church has shaped my faith. And that's kind of what we try to do, is no longer have a youth ministry that's just the teens doing stuff, but help the teens as a part of a youth ministry, helping the teens be a part of the church. Which I think Churches of Christ, for the most part, do really well. That we have always held that as a value of keeping the youth ministry, maybe not always, but the friends, at least, that I interact with, do a really good job of engaging the students in the life of the church and not just in the life of youth ministry.
Yeah. Oh, man. I really want to go down that tangent, but let's put that in the parking lot. I think what you're saying is we need to have an episode about intergenerational ministry and where it works and why it works. Because I've experienced that as well. There's a lot there. I will say just real quick, when I looked at the survey, you know, it's interesting. I'm in a weird place right now where I felt, you talked about being on the West Coast and how you've just always operated in that mindset. And I grew up in Colorado, so very much a West Coast feel, even though we were landlocked. And yeah, when I met you in college, when I moved to the South, I had never been around that church culture before, where it's just in the water that way. It was really shocking to me. And that there's a lot that I could talk about how that kind of sent me on my trajectory. But because basically what I saw there was that I felt like I saw a lot of resources being squandered, you know, and it hurt me. It hurt because I felt like there were people that needed the gospel, and that the place where there were the most concentrated Christian resources, people were busy squabbling. And that hurt. Well, it's interesting because that was 10 years ago, and I don't really have a different opinion about it, but my life has just helped me see a lot of other things. One of the things that I realize when I look at this is that there are a lot of people who should be scared when they look at numbers like this, and I understand why they do. And that's because they have invested, and I need to be more gracious about that. They've invested their entire lives into denominational structures that they believed were their way of doing the work of God, and they're watching those crumble. And I think for a lot of people, it's hard not to see that and just have a, you know, sky is falling, Chicken Little kind of mindset.
Yeah.
And so I can imagine that. I'll say, you know, there's a sad element of it too, because there's like things that you and I can't count on, right? There's like there's an esteem in the community that as pastors that you and I don't necessarily get automatically that was in previous generations.
Yeah, we have to kind of, we have bad PR, so we have to kind of work against the current. Yeah, I can see that.
And the other thing is that it's kind of weird to say, but there's a career trajectory that that may not exist anymore for a lot of people, or at least the number of people it exists for is smaller and smaller. You know, it used to be, you know, across the board, people in like our parents' age could count on being a company man and then retiring. And I think there was a, you know, a pastor as denominational company man possibility that doesn't exist anymore. And that, like, and I think that's why, like, you and I have a lot of contemporaries who have been in ministry and aren't anymore. And so a lot of times it's just practical.
Yeah.
They needed to grow financially to support their family. And, you know, their church wasn't offering retirement or daycare or maternity leave.
You know, let me springboard on that one to two things. Is that one, I have a new respect for that. Mm-hmm. That I think a few years ago I would look to them as like leaving ministry, and right, now I just see them changing the way they do ministry.
Well, yes, totally.
For the most part. Now, that's not true for everybody. Some of them have just left the faith altogether. As it applies to me, you know, I don't know how much longer youth ministry has as an industry.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Just in terms of numbers and finances and church sizes and whatnot. Right. Doesn't mean that youth ministry isn't a thing that will die soon. It just means that as an industry, it perhaps will look different. Yeah. It's a technology is what it is. It's something we created to fit within our culture to meet a need.
Right.
And that may, you know, need to look different in a few years, in 10 years, in 20 years, which is fine. And I, you know, totally okay with that. But it is a little, it can be at times a little disheartening. You're like, oh, something I love may not be here in 20 years. Well, it will be. It'll just look differently. It's like Phyllis Tickle said in an interview recently. She has cancer, by the way.
Yeah.
Did we have that conversation?
No. Oh,
yeah. So Phyllis Tickle is dying of cancer. The lady with the funniest name in the world.
Yeah.
But anyway, she says, you know, someone asked her about that. I think about the Pew Research. And I don't remember what she said, but she said something along the lines of the church isn't going to die. It's just going to look different.
Right.
And that's true. This is why when people talk to me about, say, they're interested in going into youth ministry, I tell them that's great. It might be better for you to go into teaching.
Yep.
Just in, because you're going to be, one, you're going to be around students in kind of their environment. And two, I don't know what job security looks like for youth ministries.
Yeah.
And I'm okay with that too. Like, I'm okay with saying if it's not meeting the need that it's supposed to meet, mm-hmm. as hard as that would be, then we will adapt because that's who we are. The SAPs are people who adapt. They're adapters.
Yeah.
But we'll see. None of us know the future.
Yeah, I think I would just summarize it as saying, like, there's some mourning for a simplicity of days past. And I just think about, like, and I don't want to go down this tangent at all, but there's just a lot of energy that we have to expend on hot button issues these days. And it's exhausting. And we didn't used to have to do that. And like someone like me, like I have to be bivocational. And you read a book like Eugene Peterson's book, Pastor, his memoir, where he talks about starting the church by just organizing people in his neighborhood that just needed a church.
Yeah.
Well, that's not what I get to do, you know. And
which
anyway.
Is one of the coolest things. Can I just, on the Eugene Peterson front, mm-hmm. I never realized this, or it just never hit me until a few years ago. He's at a really small church.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like what?
It's great. I love that about him.
That's so cool.
I love that about him.
Well played, Pete. We should get him on the podcast. You think we could get, hey, for season two, let's try to have like people on the podcast with us.
Besides just talking to herselves all the time?
Exactly. like we could finally introduce the world to the Paul Cartwright.
Let's do it.
Not referenced in two or three podcasts.
Well, hey, I'll just say really quickly what this means for me as a church planter.
That's a good call. Yeah, let's get back on.
Because
you can fill his tickle.
Yes. We have to do that.
Apparently you know Dallas Willard's wife.
Apparently I do. Jane, how are you?
I bet we could get her. You're the connected man. Anyway, sorry. So what does this mean for you as a church planner?
Yeah, I mean, it's not much. I think I've probably said a lot of these things before, but basically, like, this is why I'm church planting. I believe that church planting is necessary in the 21st century. And by that, like, and I should even say too that I kind of like separate anything that I would call like missional from just church planting. A lot of church planting out there is just organizing groups of Christians. But what I'm saying is kind of what you said a minute ago, like we can't be happy with our ministry just being how can we, organize the people we have. We have to think of our ministry as reaching people who are probably, that unaffiliated group.
Yeah. Sorry to interrupt you, but I think it also means we're going to have to consider what are some ways that we can engage mm-hmm. atheists and agnostics, people who have made up their minds.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Engaging is the key, you know? We didn't have to engage them because people used to come to us. Maybe that's all I'm saying. People used to come to us. People don't come to us anymore. And that's what this survey says to me. And so I really believe that, church playing is the thing that I have done and would do for free. For no other reason than I can't not do it. And that's part of that's my personality. But it is also like I view it as part of what it means to be the church in the 21st century. Any living organism does a handful of things. It moves, it eats, it sleeps, it poops, and it reproduces. And if we are, if the church is a living organism, we have to be reproducing new churches and new places in different ways.
This is probably going to get edited out. But how does the church poop?
How does the church poop? I think when we own up to things that we've done that were done for un-Jesus-like reasons, out of a desire for power, or out of a assumption of power. And we've, you know, had theology or traditions or practices that have hurt people, and we repent. That's the word. That's your answer right there. Repentance is the church's pooping.
See, I was thinking confession was the church's pooping.
Okay.
Because, well, I think that's something that let's talk about that a little bit. How do we find hope in this?
Yes. Let's turn to that.
I think that's one thing we, as maybe not as a whole, but I feel like it's on the upswing. We have embraced confession. Mm-hmm. We've embraced the need to own our flaws. And some of that, I think, is just the fact that, one, I hang out with millennials. They're all my friends, and we're all pretty, you know, open and honest people. You know, we love authenticity as millennials. But I see that across the board, too, that Gen Xers and boomers, we're all kind of embracing this. All right, you know what? We've made mistakes.
Yep.
We have a PR problem in America as a Christian, and we are to blame for that. We've stopped blaming the other guy. Not across the board. People still do it. But one thing that has come out of this, I believe, is that we have learned to embrace confession. And that can only be for the better, I think.
Yeah.
Learning to own your sins can only make you a better person.
Well, isn't that why everybody loves the Pope so much? I mean, there's a lot of nice things about him, but he leads with that. He leads with, we're not perfect, but we are doing this. I will say, when you ask about hope, I think of some of the people and places. I am incredibly blessed to get to work with people who are living in this reality and doing something about it. So I believe, you know, our church community is very committed to reaching the nuns and the duns. You know, we work so hard to have a space. And this past Sunday, I watched, you know, we've been around right about a year. And we're starting to see people who visited us almost a year ago and then disappeared start to trickle back in. And nice. I think what that is that you know, that's often the nuns or the duns who are so skeptical.
Yeah.
And so hurt often for reasons that, you know, I'm sure are legitimate but are complicated and we didn't have anything to do with. And so it takes a long time. And so what gives me hope is that we are experimenting and trying to find a way of doing church that is open and simple and sustainable so that we are still here and have enough energy to be welcoming and hospitable when those people warm up to us. You can put on a big show when you're selling tickets, but when you're waiting for people to come around, you have to do things a little simpler.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, and another thing that gives me hope is I think people who read this research and flip out and get sky is falling thoughts because they don't understand church history.
Yeah.
Not that I'm huge on church history. I've probably memorized everything wrong. But all of my favorite Christian stories and all of my favorite Christian historical moments happened from people who weren't in power.
Mm-hmm.
And people who were fighting and who were suffering and who were doing the work of the ministry even when it wasn't the popular thing to do.
Right.
You know, what Justin Martyr said, if Justin Martyr said this, the church is watered by the blood of martyrs or something like that.
Yeah.
I love that.
I
embrace that. As much as I can as a, you know, middle-class white American.
Male,
yes. You know, owning that I sit somewhat in a position of at least privilege.
Yeah.
A little bit. Although it feels like really crappy privilege.
Right. No. Yeah, I hear that.
But I look forward to that. I look forward to seeing how the Spirit moves when we've humbled ourselves and realized, well, we're not in power anymore. I guess we got to turn to Jesus a little bit.
Yeah. So, I don't want to just toot my own horn about what we're doing at Mustard Seed, because it is very much an experiment that we're figuring out. But I also have the opportunity to work with other people who are coming from even more desperate places than you and I are. And it's really cool to see. Some people get this. Some people read stuff like this, or they've known for a while, and instead of circling the wagons, there are really some people who are out there just experimenting. One of my clients that I get to work with, they don't underwrite the show or anything, but I guess I should be honest about my relationship with them, is an organization called Fresh Expressions. And Fresh Expressions initially grew out of a coalition of Anglican, Baptist, and not Anglican, Episcopal, I should, no, Church of England, the Church of England. Whatever they call themselves over there. English Methodist and English Baptist, and groups of churches like this who were just realizing, they did some serious surveys and realized really how bad things were. And, you know, it's Europe, so they're about 10 years beyond, probably more than us, down this road. And they started pouring all of their resources into what they call Fresh Expressions. And that is just, how can we equip the average person in the pew to reach the people they spend every day with, they're most, likely to hang out with, to reach those people and establish fresh forms of church that make sense in those places. And it's really a miracle, because you look at the world's most high churches, the highest of the high churches have figured out ways of equipping people to do incredibly outside of the box things. And so they've established a bit of an embassy in the U.S. working with some, groups here who are in a similar place. And it's a real privilege to work with them and say, hey, I know one gal who works with 80 and 90 year old first generation Chinese that are living alone in San Francisco and don't speak any English. And she goes and visits them and helps start house churches in their apartment complexes. I know, right? I know people that have that use other churches' gymnasiums to have worship gatherings for people with mental disabilities. I know other people who spend every day of the week on the streets with homeless people, just hanging out and hearing their stories and waiting for them to want to make some life change. And so those, when you get someone who looks at this reality that we're talking about, some people choose to join the nuns. Some people say, well, I never wanted to be affiliated with Christians anyway. Some people decide to circle the wagons, and they say angry, mean things because they're trying to, and they try to win this country back. And then some people get creative. And I just feel so privileged to get to know and even do some work with some people like that. Let's talk about hope. What do you see coming around the corner that gives you hope?
What do I see coming around the corner that gives me hope? I feel like I know. I'm going to throw this name out there. I don't think you listen to the podcast, so it doesn't matter. But maybe he does, and maybe when we post this, we'll mention him. You know, listens up. But I feel hopeful every time. Do you know Caleb Borchers?
Not personally. I know the name.
He's a church planner in some place that's in the northeastern area.
Okay.
And every time he posts about his church and his church plan, the feast, I get hopeful.
Yeah.
I feel like he's got a good head on his shoulders, and there's some good stuff either coming out of there now or going to come out of there soon. I get hopeful from that. I get hopeful from watching Mustard Seed stuff and just seeing the creativity that you guys have in terms of trying to build community. I get hopeful from the number of youth ministry books that are coming out that are, you know, that are trying to get us to say, hey, we need to start getting our parents involved in the spiritual formation of their. I'm really excited to see what comes out of the Sticky Faith in 10 years. Like that first generation of kids that we tried to get their parents to say from the very beginning, hey, take this seriously. I'm excited to see what that church looks like. You know, and I'm really excited to see just how adolescents are so less interested in materialism.
Yeah.
And you know, they replace that with experience. And this experience is the new idol. You know, it's still greed. It's just a different kind of greed.
Yeah.
But on good days, it opens them up to experiencing God.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives me hope. Yeah. That excites me.
Yeah.
And I'm really thinking that Jesus is going to come back in like a week and a half. And totally okay with that.
Yeah.
Let me be clear. I'm not making some kind of vision. I've not had anyone say it. But I have embraced over the last 2 years just to live in that expectancy of the, what's the fancy word?
Eschatological. Parousia. Ooh, parousia.
Parousia. I pray for it. I want it. And that gives me hope.
Yeah.
I anticipate Jesus' return.
Yeah.
Maybe not in the next 100 years, maybe in 1,000 years. I don't care.
Sure.
But it'll happen. And that, I'm pretty cool with that. I like that.
I like what you just said there because it's similar to what I was thinking. I think the thing that gives me the most hope is the idea of seeing people who are truly articulate and excited and purposeful about their faith. And when you talk about Jesus' return, really what you're talking about is a clear understanding, belief, and being driven by Jesus being Lord.
Yeah.
That all of this is meaningful. All of this has current and eternal significance. And yeah, it's exciting to think about a small, vibrant, almost toxic in a good way.
Yeah.
Version of the church where it's just so tangible that people are excited and different and driven by their faith in resurrection and the power of the Holy Spirit.
Yeah, it's cool. And I think it's good. I think this Pew Research isn't scary for me. It's just, it's new challenges. It's new opportunities. Like, okay, so we lost 8% in the last 7 years. All right, well, let's do better in the next 7 years.
Yeah, yeah. Or let's do something that we didn't do.
Yeah.
Let's see. I'll say this. There's one organization that I got to meet recently that really filled me with hope, and it was this. It was a group that is funding our church plant and other church plants, and I got to talk to the president of this group, the guy whose name goes on the checks, and he said, we all realize that these things don't always work. In fact, it takes 3 or 4 times before you get one that works, and we're here to do these experiments. And that was so relieving and exciting to me that, you know, there are churches, denominations, and individuals who get this. Let's go out there. Let's try something different. Let's leave it all out on the field. Sometimes it'll work. Sometimes it won't. But it's all, you know, it's all to the glory of God.
Yeah.
Good.
Well.
Good stuff.
Good stuff. That's all I got.
Well, so thanks, Pew Research.
Thanks, Pew.
Pew. Do you think that's really their name, or it's like a joke off of pews because it's about religious stuff and people in churches sit in pews?
I assume.
Yeah. Yeah. I just, at first I thought it was someone's name, and then I was like, no way.
The founder, Ken Pew. Ken Pew sounds like either an Asian girl or a sound effect from a Batman movie.
Pew! Yeah. Pew-pew. Like something when Adam West punches someone.
Yeah, or like he shoots a bat.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Nice.
Well, hey, thank you, podcast listeners. Don't forget to go to our Facebook page. Mm-hmm. And if you want us, Subscribe to us on iTunes.
Yes.
Boost us. If you know a friend who wants to listen to a podcast on tear gas and gumdrops, then I think we're the only one doing it right now. Yeah. So, well, you know.
Yeah, so get it while the getting's good.
Yeah, and shout out again to our number one fan, Chris Morton's mother.
Hey, Mom.
We love you, and we're going to get you a t-shirt or something.
Hey, serious shout out, though, to Joe Stroop, who left us a 5-star review on iTunes.
Joe's my buddy.
Joe's your buddy? Well, thanks.
Joe's my friend, yeah.
So, Kyle, Joe, if you have any other friends, tell them to leave us 5-star reviews.
Joe has actually, fun fact, he has listened to multiple podcasts, so multiple, like, he's not like a one-and-done friend, like, he's, so, and Joe is a good guy. If we can have other people on our podcast in a season, we should have Joe. Joe's quality.
All right, well, let's throw that out there, with the caveat that you can make suggestions, but we won't necessarily go for everything. Yeah, who would you like to hear on the podcast? A buddy of mine just interviewed N.T. Wright. It took him 2 years, but so who knows?
We're going to be doing this podcast for at least 2 more seasons. I'm okay.
Yeah. All right, man. Well, happy Wednesday.
Happy Wednesday. And are we done recording?
I think so.